This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
Oh, I'm Rebecca Lindland from Rebecca Drives. I keep forgetting I'm second.
We're gonna have to work on this.
And I'm Sam Abual Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
All right. Well, welcome to episode 159. We're going to keep it tight. I promise. I promise. So let's talk about what we're driving. Sam, we had
promised that every episode for the last 158.
Listen, it is 11:45 a.m. on Tuesday morning right now. We're gonna get this done.
All right.
So, Sam, since you're giving me crap, what are you driving? What have you been driving?
So, I had the BMW 228i xDrive Grand Coupe, yet another in BMW
very fancy
kind of overly complex names, but
was so it Das Scheiß?
Currently in the BMW lineup, in the 2 Series lineup, there are two very distinctly different vehicles. And when I say different, I mean like they are completely different. There is, there's the 2 Series coupe and convertible, which is built on a rear drive platform, which I think is shared largely with 3 Series. And then there's the 2 Series Grand Coupe, and also in Europe, there are other variants as well, which are actually built on a transverse engine front-wheel drive platform that is shared with Mini. It's the same platform used for the Mini Countryman. And so it's also used for the X1 and the X2 and a few other things that we don't get here. So the Grand Coupe is on this transverse engine front drive platform. Nice, four-door, fastback sedan, decent styling, nothing too exciting. It doesn't have an excessively large grill. It looks fine. Interior is nice enough, typical, modern BMW. And the engine, the powertrain is the 2-liter turbo, 4-cylinder, 228 horsepower, and all-wheel drive. So for the U.S. market, it's only available with all-wheel drive. There's no front-wheel drive version offered here of the 2 Series Grand Coupe. You can also get it as a 235, which has 300 horsepower. But the base version, is adequate. The performance wasn't really a problem with this. I had no complaints about the at least the acceleration performance and braking. Steering was kind of numb and non-existent. Nothing much there. Didn't really have any opportunity to evaluate the extra traction capabilities of the all-wheel drive. My big complaint about this thing is, like so many modern BMWs, is it's really expensive for what you're getting. Base price on the 228 starts at $37,500, and the one I had was about $49,000.
And, that's a lot of money for a Dodge Dart.
Yeah, it is. When you look at the specs, this car is almost exactly the same size, similar wheelbase and so on to cars like the Honda Civic and the Mazda 3 sedan. In fact, the Mazda 3 has actually got slightly more room inside and actually a notably bigger trunk. Currently, the Mazda 3 sedan, the top end version of that is the premium, which with all wheel drive, and currently there's only one engine in there. That's the 2.5 liter naturally aspirated 4-cylinder, 186 horsepower. That one with all wheel drive is $29,000, and that's loaded and it's got everything in it.
You're driving a Mazda as opposed to a BMW. So when you go into the bar to impress the chicks, it's not going to happen.
True. But I don't go into the bar to impress the chicks.
Well, I will say.
I want a car that I actually enjoy driving.
Right, yeah.
And Mazda this fall will have the 2.5 liter turbo that's in the CX-9 and the CX-5 and also in the Mazda 6 coming to the Mazda 3. So you'll have a 250 horsepower all-wheel drive Mazda 3 that I think arguably has an actually nicer interior. I think the design has probably more character than the 228. It's probably going to cost about $32,000, $33,000 because the Mazda 6 turbo is $35,000. So it's probably going to be, you know, in that price range. So $5,000 less than the base price of the 228.
I agree with you. The pricing, it's funny that you mentioned pricing because I was just putting up my review of the Cadillac XT6 and Nicole Wakeland had driven the BMW X7 and she put her review up on my site and it was like $100,000+. And the Cadillac was like my test version tapped out at $63,000 and the XT6 tops out at about 72-ish. Mm-hmm. And while the X7 is bigger, it still really struck me that that's that's another half a car difference. It's $30,000 difference. And I don't know that you're getting $30,000 worth of value.
Especially, you know, I haven't driven the X7 yet, but you know, certainly with the 228, I don't see that you're actually getting, you know, even $5,000 or $10,000 worth of extra value, you know, aside from, you know, the cachet of it having that BMW badge on it, you know, that twin kidney grill.
You should feel that though. Like you should feel that you are in this a BMW. You should feel that you should have that experience. When you're driving a BMW, that should be something that comes through every time in my mind.
And in the 228, you know, more so, I think, you know, in the 2 Series coupe, you know, that is definitely more the case. You know, it feels more lively. You know, it of all current BMWs, you know, that I've driven, the 2 Series coupe is actually probably my favorite. It's the most, it's got that classic BMW feel to it, you know, lighter, nimbler. You know, the Grand Coupe, it just, I don't know, it doesn't have that feel to it.
So is this almost like a stepping stone car? Like if I sort of squint at this, you can see that BMW is working a bit to evolve their design language because it's different proportions. This is front wheel drive. And they're trying to find where that lower sort of rung of their cars are that entry level. This would be the 3 Series, which has sort of grown and gotten more expensive. It's still an icon, but they need something to fill in that slot that the 3 Series filled for so long. And so I'm wondering if that's what this car is sort of meant to do as they're working to establish the 2 Series, sort of sedan, Grand Coupe, whatever else however else they want to make it. But you know, you can see that they're working some things out. And on the website, you know, they show the premium models, which I think they look pretty good. They probably also cost like $7,000.
Yeah, it looks fine. You know, I think it's a little more plain.
Yeah.
You know, than, you know, 3 Series or 5 Series, but you know, I don't have any real complaints about the design. It's just, you know, the driving experience in it doesn't really excite me.
Yeah, well, I think that's where it needs to not fall down, right? It can't drive like an economy car.
It's got to be the ultimate driving machine.
Yeah,
it has to live up, regardless of the size of these vehicles. It has to live up to that tagline.
It's got to remind you of a 2002 or a 325.
A lot of BMWs have failed to do that over the past decade.
Yeah, well, because that's not what they're about anymore. And if you want that's Mazda. If you want a 2002, go buy a Mazda 3, like you were saying, or the Mazda 6. Like that's going to give you that feeling. Not so much the 2 or the 3 Series. The 3 Series will give you a little bit of that. But
the new 3 Series is definitely a step up compared to the previous generation.
I think we also have to make the note that most BMWs are leased. You know, so that's a different price point than, I mean, I realize the MSRP still comes into play, but, you know, that is something to think about too, that most of these vehicles are leased. And I would think that you can probably get a gently used one for a pretty good price.
Yeah. Well, you could probably lease a used one for, but they're leased by that guy at the bar who wants to impress the chicks. Like you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
It is like some of this end of the market is going to be people looking for a performance bargain and they're going to buy the hot rod version. And I don't necessarily mean performance bargain because it's still going to be expensive, but they're looking for that. But the other buyer is the one who just buys it because of the brand. and because they like the tech that's in it or something. You know, how is the tech, by the way? How is iDrive and all that stuff? And it has light up trim. Does it have the light up trim?
No, this one did not. But the iDrive, you know, was basically the same in this as what you'd find in pretty much any other modern BMW, which is good. I mean, it's a good system. You know, it has this one has the My BMW assistant in there, so you know, you can, as you're driving along, you don't have to find the voice button on the steering wheel. You know, just say, you know, hey BMW, you know, turn up the volume, turn, you know, I'm cold, turn down the temperature, things like that. So it's actually a pretty good system. You know, it does, you know, various controls, so you don't even have to mess with the control knob. So that system actually works really well. And, you know, if you're looking, you know, if you're doing navigation, it will, you know, it's got, it's not true natural language, but it's a lot closer to natural language processing. You know, so you don't have to go through a whole bunch of steps to enter a navigation command. You know, just say, you know, navigate home, you know, or navigate to Whole Foods, you know, and then, you know, and if there's multiple choices, it'll show, you know, show the list on the screen, say pick one. But, you know, if you give it a specific address, you know, it will do that in one sequence. You don't have to go through multiple steps to do it, which has long been the complaint with voice control systems in cars, is, you know, having to remember the exact syntax and going through multiple steps of, you know, what's the house number, what's the street number, what's city,
you know, all that nonsense. It's like being on a phone tree.
Yeah. So, you know, these, you know, modern vehicles, you know, have the ability to do much closer to natural language voice processing, and makes them a lot more useful and a lot more effective.
Okay. So the final verdict, though, sounds like just buy the Mazda 3 with the turbo when it comes here, and don't spend your cash on the BMW.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if what you want is a BMW badge, fine, you know, go for it. But if you actually want what a BMW used to represent in terms of driving capabilities, then, you know, maybe wait for the Mazda.
Okay. All right. Let's jump on. Let's move on. Rebecca, your turn. You were driving the XT6. You mentioned it. I actually had an XT6 back in the before times. we took it to Manhattan, actually, last summer. Funny. And it's a little big for that, but it's narrowish. It's not like driving a Suburban or a Tahoe in town. So I actually thought it was great for that. It was great on the highway. I had the Platinum, so it was more than the one you've got. And I kind of struggled with the value a little bit, just like we are with the BMW, but I want your take on it. And there's a link we'll put in the show as well to Rebecca Drives for the XT6 premium review.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. So, so I was actually in a unique position, hopefully a unique position, of actually really needing this car, because I didn't have power and I didn't have internet after Tropical Storm Isisa or Aziza or whomever, him. And so I was delighted when this vehicle showed up the day after the storm, because I know it has a Wi-Fi hotspot. Yep. So I didn't actually track my fuel economy on this one because I spent so much time idling in the car.
Yeah, I will say its fuel economy is about what you can expect from something that size. It's going to be in the 20s.
So. Yeah, it's rated for 17 city, 24 highway, 20 combined, which I would say I actually got pretty close to that, which is impressive considering how much, that's what I should have said, is it's impressive considering how much I had it idling while I checked email and you know, just getting online and everything. So, you know, this is one of those things where this is a product where I feel like it did a lot of things really, really well and with minimal drama. And I appreciated that especially given the circumstances that I was in, where my mom didn't have power. My mom and my sister, they lived together. Her house didn't have power. My brother didn't have power. I didn't have power. And this went on for days and days and days. And so you know, being able to charge my phone, being able to get online with the Wi-Fi hotspot was really a big thing and a big help. And so, you know, it's one of those extras that, that GM has offered for years, and I don't think gets enough credit for. So once I was out on the road in the XT6, you know, overall, it's a really good, I would say mid-size plus is how I saw it described, which I thought was a good description of it.
I mean, it's the nicest Traverse there is.
Well, actually, it's actually based on the XT5, not the Traverse platform.
Well,
it's a stretched XT5.
There.
Okay. No, it did. I thought it drove well, especially in sport mode.
Yes, yes, for sure. I mean, there, you know, I went down to JFK to pick up my sister when she and her husband and daughter flew in from Florida or Kentucky, rather. They were on vacation. She was at a horse camp kind of thing. And, you know, it was very easy to load and unload the bags, you know, very comfortable in the back. My niece was able to charge all of their devices because they were going home to a dark house. And so I do think that, you know, from a driving and overall just one week of ownership experience, I think it just did a lot of things really well. You know, it was, things were ergonomic where I wanted them to be. I would not have minded more USB ports, and maybe, you know, maybe the upper trims do that. This was the premium, which I think is kind of in the middle. The base of the car is 58,000, and then this was as tested was 63, almost 64,000. So it didn't have a ton of accoutrements, but that's okay. I mean, if you want even more, you can get this up to 73,000, as I mentioned. But, you know, the fit and finish was really nice. I'm not crazy about the shiny interior. I like to have a matte finish more. And that was a part of the review that I had to take out because I'm confined to 200 words. So the only thing that I would have liked and I would have preferred for a little bit more upscale feel is a matte finish.
Shiny on the trim, you mean? Like
on the trim, yeah. Right, on the trim. So it still has that, you know, like the, how like the piano black, this wasn't piano black, but it's shiny. I mean, it's, yeah, basically it's shiny and it has that kind of shiny feel. I like that matte, soothing, open pore wood kind of, yeah, experience. Well, a little bit more.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the pictures too. Like, it actually looks like it's wood too. It's just, it's been varnished.
Right. Yeah. Know? It's grained. Like, it has a grain.
Yeah.
So facade. I don't think to I've it, seen you know? That before. And again, I mean, it's nice. It was, you know, the buttons and the switches were fine. They were where they were supposed to be. It had a very, very good, very handy wireless charging slot that worked really, really well. Even when I have one of those, you know, finger hold things on the back of my phone, yeah, that just, and so a lot of wireless chargers don't work with it, but this one did really well. 8-inch screen. The screen did get a lot of fingerprints on it, which was sub-op, but, you know, overall it was nicely done. I thought that the V6 engine responded really, really well. Plenty of power whenever I wanted it. I really, you know, I enjoyed the driving experience with it. And one of the things that, and just for clarity, it has 310 horsepower, as I dug through their site to find, to discover, a 9-speed automatic. But, you know, I think that I think overall, driving this Cadillac XT6 was just a good, solid experience for me. And I enjoyed it. I think it's a really good family car. I think it's, you know, the price point for what you're getting, I feel like, is actually pretty good. It's expensive. It's a Cadillac. It's supposed to be expensive. But I felt like overall, it really lived up to the name.
Yeah.
So I liked it.
I struggled a little bit more with it living up to its name. I did think it does drive very well. I thought the interior, and the one I had didn't have even the contrasting color. Like, you had brown seats with the contrast stitching. Mine was all black. And so,
oh, that's brutal.
Again, my complaint about an all black interior, like, okay, it's a $90,000+ car, but I can't tell you if it's good or bad, you know, like, they feel okay, but just, you know how that, it just,
I'm not crazy about black interiors, yeah, at all.
For me, like, one of the things you're paying for is the design and the style and the colors and material choices. And if you go with all black, it's either like well, you don't have any imagination, or like you're trying to hide something. So that's kind of on the people that spec the cars, both for the fleet and for the dealers when the dealers are ordering inventory.
Yes.
You can get colors in these, and it does. It looks a lot better.
And Cadillac has some really great color options for the interiors.
Yeah,
they do. The other thing that is of note, it doesn't affect the experience at all, but man, they love that emblem outline, that shield thing. Like that is everywhere.
Well, that's, you know, like that's consistent branding. So I'll give them that. I'm still a little bit miffed. They took the murlets off. They keep taking elements off the shield, but that's okay.
Yeah. But it is, I mean, that is reflected everywhere. Yeah. It's hilarious.
It's good looking. I think that it's going to struggle to compete with the Navigator in terms of the first impression it makes. Because the Navigator,
well, and it's not really.
Not the Navigator, I'm sorry. The
Aviator.
The Aviator, right, yeah. Well, it's in an interesting niche, though, because it's a pretty comfortable 7-seat.
Yeah.
But it's not huge, you know, it really is that kind of midsize plus. I mean, it's, if you want a little bit more room, if you want, you know, a little bit more than a midsize, but not as big right. as something like the X7, the Escalade, the Navigator, this is that it slots in there kind of nicely, I think.
Yeah. I feel like it's a great choice. It's a great size. You know, especially where the way we both used it, right? Like, that's the perfect use case for these. And that's what people are doing with them. It's you're a round town car. You know what? Yep. I got to go pick up a bunch of people. Cool. My car can do it. I've got extra seats. We're going to run to the airport. Like,
yes.
And last year, you know, last summer when I went on the launch drive for this thing in DC, I actually did sit in the third row for, you know, when we were coming back from dinner.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, because, you know, the proportions that they gave this thing, you know, it's a little bit taller than an Aviator is. It's shorter. It's not as long, but it is a little bit taller. So you sit a little more upright, but, you know, but that third row is actually pretty useful even for adults. I mean, I wouldn't want to go on a long road trip, you know, sitting in the third row. I mean, I'm 5'11", but you know, for, you know, just to go out to dinner or something, you know, have, you know, three couples in there, not a big deal. You could definitely do it.
Yeah. No, I think I really liked this size. It was easy for me to get in and out of also. The seats, you know, adjust 15,000 different ways. So the visibility was quite good as well. You know, I didn't have any issues with the A-pillar. I mean, and one of the things too is that I was literally dodging down trees and branches at any moment because Greenwich, I mean, it looks like mini tornadoes went through this place. And so, you know, all of a sudden I would have to stop.
You could win a post-storm autocross with this thing.
Yes, exactly.
But that was the surprising part was, you know, the chassis tuning and the steering feel and everything, especially when you put it in sport mode, if it had the adaptive
steering. Yeah, the different modes. You have drive modes, for sure.
It felt like it was tuned by people who tune cars.
Who care about it.
I man, I went right the hell up the merit on this thing
thank you for stopping by.
Well, this was a year or something.
Blah, 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 blah.
Next time I will. We have to get pizza.
Excellent, yes.
But
bring your own pepperoni, please.
We'll get to that.
No pineapple.
I used every bit of the 300-something horsepower, you know, and it's a revver, so you gotta get it up in the RPM range a little bit to make that, to get that power, but it just, you know, it feels pretty good. So I was impressed with it. Where I'm less impressed with it is I didn't like the capacitive touch stuff on the center console. Like, it works and it's not bad for what it is, but it's frustrating and distracting. And then just some of the other switch gear that's around it and stuff. And just, so there's for the money, you start to scratch your head, especially when you look at the competition and you go, well, this one feels nicer, whether or not it's actually nicer, even just the Telluride. Yeah. And we'll come back to those.
Yeah, you know? I mean, absolutely. But I think on the switches, the only issue, I had two things. I hated the fact, and this is really stupid, but I hated the fact that the volume was sideways. It ran horizontally. I really like vertical, up and down.
Oh, is it like a rocker switch or a slider or something?
It's two separate buttons, and they run horizontally on the right side of the steering wheel. And I hated that. It was never something I could get used to. The other thing is the cruise control. putting it in it, it doesn't default to adaptive cruise control. So you have to like ask it. And I've run into this with other GM products as well. And you've got to like press a button and then tap the top of your head and rub your belly at the same time and be driving simultaneously. Yeah. It was super complicated. And I the first time, once I got it in adaptive cruise control, it seemed to stay there, but it was very, very distracting. And it was really complicated. And I did it while I was on the highway, of course, because that's when you do these things, when you're trying to use adaptive cruise control. But I was thankful that I finally got it there, because I just found it to be really, really distracting. And I don't know, did you have that experience at all?
I don't remember it being difficult, but there are some cars that it does, like they have two different buttons and you've got to look and see which one and decipher that. The Hyundai Ioniq I drove last week, I think, had the same thing, where it was a button for cruise and a different button for adaptive cruise. Or maybe it was the Ram. And we'll get to everything I've been driving.
Yes, I know. We do have to get to everything you've been driving.
But I don't remember it being that difficult. I do remember not liking the secondary controls that much.
Maybe it's not intuitive for me. And you know how I am with technology. Well, I can break it really easily.
When you're
so
designing technology, that's your job, is to make it easy for people
who say
it should just work.
Yeah.
I just thought it would default. I can appreciate having the choice, because yeah, I think there are a lot of people, I'm not a huge fan of adaptive cruise control. So I appreciate having the choice. My issue was that it was so complicated getting there.
Yeah, and it's cruise is pretty good, but it's not right for every situation. And that's the same with every car, you know, like
exactly.
Sometimes you want regular cruise.
So what are you driving anyway?
So this week I'm finishing up with a Subaru Outback XT Onyx Edition.
And oh, my neighbor just bought a Subaru Outback on my recommendation, Subaru.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good wagon. It's priced well.
Just send the check to RebeccaDrives.com.
Exactly.
this one has the
or advertising dollars.
The sorry, WRX that engine. So that's I think the bigger change, where before you had the 2.5 liter that had like 180 something horsepower. This gets the turbo 2.4 that has 260 something. So it's a lot more lively. It's actually pretty quick on its feet. Which is an interesting trick with the CVT that is still, it's good, but it's still dopey because it's a CVT. But it does, it has a powerful bit of torque to it that was missing from the last Legacy and Outback that I drove. So that's good. The powertrain has been upgraded. It looks good. It's pretty comfortable in this trim. Again, it's priced pretty well. It doesn't drive great. That's my problem. Like it's a solid platform. You can tell that they've done a lot of work to make sure that the body structure is pretty rigid. So it rides okay, but it's bouncy, is as my wife described it. You know, and it's sort of like a mid-rise, you know, so it's not a full SUV, but they've taken a wagon and made it an SUV. And so they've added some sort of nautical motion to the to the suspension, which I don't really like. You know, it'll hang on if you make it, you know, go through a set of curves. It'll do fine. It's not a bad.
Is it underdamped or oversprung?
It feels oversprung. Like it's not stiff in that sense, though. Like, you know, like oversprung would imply that it's like harsh over bumps. It's not really. It's, you know what it is. It's maybe it's not enough roll bar, you know, like, it leans over, but it also like tosses your head around a little bit. Like, and that's,
was this in every situation? Like
no, I mean,
do you think it's because it's got to have that like level of off-road or ruggedness to it?
Well, I think they've had to balance a lot of things, you know, it's got higher ride height. It's got to have, you know, compliance. It's okay. It's good over bad pavement. It's actually decent on like gravel roads and stuff. I thought it was actually quite in its element there. It felt really good. So they've had to make this all arounder. And so in certain situations, you know, like the middle of a curve on a broken pavement back road here in New England, where there's like a zillion of that, it'll start to bounce your head around a little bit. And so it feels a little bit rough but not harsh, which is we're using all kinds of adjectives that don't make any sense. but I didn't love the ride, and I didn't love the handling, because I think it's what it's supposed to be. It's trusty. It's not going to get you in trouble, so that's fine. The on center feel, like if you're on the highway or something, it sort of wanders a bit, you know, and that's something that I think is probably a function of the tires and the tuning and all of that together. But really, when I'm on the highway, I want a car that like locks in.
Kind of like a mid-70s old Cutlass.
Yeah, not quite as bad. You can't steer it with your pinky, you know, like,
yeah, I'm sure that's what they were going for.
Fully lock to lock. You know, it's a good car. They really know their market. I love how Subaru is really, they've got a lot of thought put into the way you can accessorize it for the stuff you're going to do with it, you know, and so you can get the different roof rack options and the different storage and stuff like that. They're really dog friendly brand, which I think is cool, because once you become a dog owner, this is one of those things that nobody tells you, but once you become a dog owner like that, they are more precious to you than your children. And you want to take them everywhere and do everything with them. And the cars, Subaru is a brand that's really attentive to that. And I really liked I actually quite liked the interior in this one. It has, it's like their version of MBTEX. It's like Subaru Tex or StarTex or whatever upholstery. So it's not leather, but it's not like cheap vinyl. It's a material that feels good to the touch. It looks good. The seats are pretty comfortable in this particular one. So, you know, I give it marks for design and interior quality, which are two areas. Interior quality is an area that Subaru has just struggled with in the past. So they're coming up on the competition there. The problem is ergonomics have taken a whack, and Subaru has always been good with ergonomics, but they've got this new tablet size center screen that's like their version of Sensus, and it's not any better.
I remember that thing. That thing is huge. Yeah. In the center. Yeah. Because yeah. Well, I went on this drive.
11-inch screen.
It's a big screen. It's nice when you do CarPlay. It uses a portion of the screen for CarPlay and still leaves some other stuff down below. But you know, the secondary controls are confusing, and you know,
they do have a volume and tuning knob.
They
though,
do. I will give
which
them
I do appreciate.
Props for that. Sometimes that volume knob became very unresponsive, so you just sit there spinning it and you'd get nothing, and then all of a sudden just do like full blast and then off, and it's just like, yeah. So it's a great way to want to punch the screen. You know, I don't love the graphics on it. I think that all automakers get a little too distracted making these things look really sharp for presentations or brochures, and what is really necessary when you consider what you're asking people to do is take the colors out, increase the contrast, don't get too fancy, don't use animations and stuff, and make these things really easy to glance at. And that's one of the problems I have, is that the elements are kind of small. Like the HVAC controls, when you go to adjust them, they'll come up larger on the screen. You can do what you need to do, but you have to stare at it to figure out what it is you want when you're new to the car. I think as an owner, this probably goes away a little bit, but you still got to look at it to figure out what you're trying to ask it to do. And if you look too long, it times out and it shrinks back down. Oh, it's like, no, leave the controls where I want
them.
That's
brutal.
This is why none of that stuff should ever be in a touchscreen interface. It needs to be physical controls that don't move. They're always in the same place. You can do it by feel without looking at them.
Look, there's nothing wrong with
three
knobs.
I would agree
knobs.
With you there.
You know, like I get it. You want to leave it in auto. Fine. Like that's the answer, is leave it in auto. But that's not all of us want that.
And, well, you should. Well, just like
I get it.
Pepperoni pizza.
I love a good pepperoni pizza. But you have to, as a designer of machines that people are going to use too, like you've got to create more than one way to skin a cat, because
hey, none of that.
That's where you have to study. And it's like, some people are going to do it exactly the way you want to do it, and that's great. But other people are going to, they're going to break your stuff, and you have to account for them breaking your stuff and make it so that your stuff doesn't break. And the input mode doesn't become really frustrating. So I thought that there was some annoyances, you know, another thing, like there was no real place to stick my phone, except for a little cubby up in front of the shifter, which is also where the port for USB and for CarPlay is. And that's actually awkward to plug the cable in. Like, I had to finagle my wrist around to get in there. It's, you can't.
Yeah, that's not okay.
And I was like,
Is there a USB port in the center console?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe under the armrest or something. The charging port is right there.
Well, because, you know, there still is that conversation of that you should be putting your phone away, you know, well, that's why
I asked, you know, a lot of times you'll find a USB port up in the front, like what you just described, Dan, and then additional ports in the center console bin under the armrest. So you plug in there, put your phone in there, and then you don't touch it again while you're driving.
That may be easier, but then you forget the phone, you know, like, again, accounting for people and us weirdos. That's not a bad thing to, I'll look for that. It's difficult to plug stuff into that one that's up in front of the shifter. Like you can't actually reach the port under the way they designed the opening. It's
right. So it's like very awkward to get around.
Yeah. And that was surprising. You know, I think that it's definitely overall, it's a great car. If you want a Legacy an Outback, you know what you're going to get. You know, it's matured steadily with each generation. It hasn't lost the Subaru character, which I think that's a pretty neat trick because it's gotten a lot more refined every time they've redone it.
Is this also designed and sold in Japan? Because I'm wondering if it's easier on the right-hand drive.
I don't know.
To reach those controls. Because I run into this with other cars.
It seems like they're pretty, like, where these are, they're not tilted one way or another. They're just straight,
I'm looking at a photo of it
right, right now, but I just wonder if you are like with your, you know, if you're sitting on the right, if you're on the driver's seat on the right side, is it easier
to
slot in as opposed to sitting on the left side and then you're reaching, you know, kind of reaching around the center console or reaching around the shift, the gear selector and such.
For the way left hand, I'll sit in the passenger seat and fiddle with it.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look like it would be from looking at this because it's, you know, everything's all pretty much lined up along the center line of the car.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't look like it would make any difference really which direction you were coming at it
from. But you know, I'll play with it because, you know, just the way your wrists work and stuff, that's interesting. I'll fiddle with that.
If you still have the car, I think that'd be curious to see if it does make any difference. It's just a, you know, like an idea of to try that because I've run into that. I remember sitting in a Lexus one time and the footwell came out. I was in the driver's seat and the footwell came out and hit me. I remember talking about on the show on this. It hit me in the knee and I was like, what is going on with this? And it's because they didn't change it for the right and left-hand side. Huh. And so it's you're fine as a passenger with that there, but once you become the driver, it causes problems. And so that's what made me think of it. Like, Is it an ergonomics thing? But yeah, I agree, Sam. Looking at the pictures, it doesn't seem like it would be. But it's a nice looking interior. They did a nice job, I think, with materials. And I remember having a little bit different experience. I quite enjoyed driving it. At the same time, I hadn't spent a lot of time in a Subaru. And so, you know, we did off-roading. We took it on some nice trails and stuff. And it was really, really good for that. So I always give a car that is good on off road. I always give it a little bit more leeway on road if it can, you know, if it's well behaved on road as well, but you're always, it sounds like there's just some compromises that are going on. I'd love to have one here at home at some point to really just drive it on the highway on paved roads and see how it is.
And it's not bad. I think what I wanted was it to be a little bit more plush on the road, or just a little bit more disciplined, with that, the way it sort of holds the center lane on the highway, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Some of that's personal preference. I think if you are looking for a vehicle like this, there's not a whole lot of choice, especially now that Buick's leaving the market. There's the Volkswagen is a little smaller.
You mean that like semi-wagon crossover kind of feel?
And then you've got, you know, more expensive choices. So this is in a really sweet spot. This is under $40,000. It's really well equipped. It's very nicely outfitted. It's comfortable. It looks good. It's really functional. It has all the safety tech, you know, the eyesight stuff. And that actually works pretty well. The adaptive cruise works well. The lane centering actually works.
It's got all-wheel drive.
Decently. Yeah. You know, with the new engine, it has pleasing power. It's actually quick. And it doesn't use as much gas as the old the 3.6R used to be the way to get a powerful Outback, and that one sounded awesome because it was a flat six, sounded like a Porsche, but it swilled fuel. This one is going to give you better fuel economy, especially with the CVT. So it's a really solid update. I think the controls and stuff that bugs us may not bug other folks quite as much, although, you know, given the wide demographic of people that buy these, some people are going to get it and really immediately take to it. Other people, like my parents, who are in their 70s, and my mom drives a Forester. I think some of that stuff, and she told me, she's like, it does all kinds of stuff I don't know how to do. I was like, that's kind of good.
That's
and bad.
Cute.
Like, it's good that it defaults to being on, but it's bad that, like, you're not going to know what it's doing when it does what it does, you know? Like,
well, and keep in mind, too, that Onyx Edition, you mentioned the water repellent upholstery.
Yeah.
And so that Onyx is a kind of a special for a special specific audience.
It's the dog car.
Say. But it is, you know, as opposed to like the Limited or that Touring, the Limited XT, the top of the line, you know, so the Touring XT rather is the top of the line. But, you know, that Onyx Edition does have some specifically designed features, particularly that water repellent upholstery.
Yeah, it may actually even have a different suspension tune on it that is a little different than the Limited or the Touring. So,
Yeah, it's got the dual function X mode, the
yes.
hill descent control.
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, so that, I mean, it's a cool, as you said, like it's a cool looking vehicle. It's, you know, but it is designed. I mean, maybe that suspension is a little bit looser for off road. Yeah,
that could be. It felt great when I had it on gravel roads. I wanted to go fast and rally drive.
Well, and again, that's what you're going to compromise a little bit on, right?
Yeah.
Like when you have that feeling, you know, of being able, that confidence of being able to go fast on a gravel road, that same confidence may not translate quite as easily to pavement.
So, all right. The other stuff I was starting, I had for the storm, my mobile office was a 2020 Ram 1500 Laramie Night Edition. This was a $68,000 awesome. 1500. Which is absurdly expensive. And I don't think it even had that many options. I like it had a couple of expensive option packages. One of them was, I think, 3,000. The other was like 4,000. But I'm looking at the sticker. I'm like, it doesn't seem like it's that much of a stretch to get from 46, which is the base price of this model, to 68, which is where it wound up. It's like, that's so much money for a 1500. It's a nice truck. It's the Laramie, so it's you know, nicely appointed inside. It was very comfortable to leave it idling in the driveway while I tethered and charged up stuff. I had my video editing stuff.
How long did you guys lose power for?
We lost power for about a day, 24 hours.
Okay.
So just long enough to ruin a bunch of stuff in the fridge.
Nice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. My whole fridge went.
Yeah. I went and borrowed a generator. It was a truck was handy to pick up a generator from my brother-in-law and you know, we get this, it's a big one, it's 8,500 watts, and we put it down, start it up, plug stuff in the house, and then 3 hours later, zip, all the power comes back.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Of course.
But that's okay. So, you know, this had the eTorque V8, which is good. It feels a little bit more punchy than you'd expect because the Hemi is a little bit, has a lot to deal with the Ram 1500. This is a heavy truck, and that is what sort of dings it in payload. It trailering is fine, but the Ram you have to sort of carefully look at in 1500s, like what can I actually put in this and also put people in and stuff, because its payload number is really a function of which engine, which drive system, and which cab you've got. So it's a really nice luxury car. I don't think it's, you know, as much a pickup as it is just a classical full frame luxury car. This is your Imperial.
With a really big trunk.
Yeah, with an enormous trunk. You know, and I actually didn't like the tonneau cover that it has. It's a three-piece tonneau that folds up. It folds up weird. It's kind of cumbersome. That's an accessory, so just watch out for that. I liked all the features. You know, it had power running boards, and it had the tailgate. I don't know what the Ram tailgate is.
Split tailgate.
Yeah, but it had the split tailgate that opens like a door, you know, a pair of doors or down. And it's very clever, and it looks like a durable solution that, you know, isn't quite as fiddly as the GMC Multi-Pro tailgate that's like a Swiss Army knife. So, you know, the Ram is easy to love. It's very comfortable. It rides and handles like, you know, it weighs a gazillion pounds because it does. It's geared well, though. You know, the powertrain is really good. I think this engine transmission combo is as worthy of praise as any of the GM small block stuff. It's just a really good powertrain. And the e-torque, I think, helps fill in the gaps. So it's a nice truck, but it's also like if you're buying a $68,000 pickup, you need to address your priorities. The 1500 is not where you should be. If you need a work truck, you should be buying a heavy duty truck, which is also going to be nice for $70,000. So that's sort of my quick take on that. And then the Ioniq PHEV, I quite liked that, but I think that is a dead man walking. Just that car segment. They need to take that tech and put it in regular cars and crossovers. You know, like
which is, you know, to their credit, is what they're doing. You know, you've got the Sonata hybrid, the Elantra hybrid. There's a Sonata plug-in hybrid, I think, coming back again. You know, same basic thing, but you know, with a 2-liter engine instead of the 1.6. We'll probably see that plug-in in the next generation Tucson. So they're putting it into a bunch of stuff.
But they're also expanding the Ioniq brand name.
Right.
When that's good, because
as we talked about last time.
Did we talk about that last week?
You guys did talk about it. Yeah.
Okay, I couldn't remember.
I thought we talked about it last week.
The door is definitely closing for this sort of dedicated hybrid model. You know, Toyota's not selling as many Priuses as it used to, and I think this Ioniq is the same thing. It does exactly what it says it's going to do. So it's a very good hybrid. It actually felt pretty sporty to drive in a surprising way. You know, there's just genuine steering feel, and the low rolling resistance tires are just the right amount of greasy, so you can actually slide it around a little bit, which I thought was surprising and amusing. And it's, you know, this I had the Limited, so it's nicely appointed, and I didn't find the touch sensitive switches as objectionable here. The Hyundai infotainment is and secondary controls are better done. So
I think I'm getting that vehicle in a couple of weeks, actually.
I hope it's not the one that I drove. I mean, you know,
let me. I'll look and see. Own
scars on it. I actually didn't do anything to damage it.
Thank you. I'll look and see which. I don't know if she's giving me the trim level that I'm getting.
Yeah, it's a nice car. I'll be interested to see what you have to say about it. It's a little loud on the highway, but you know that's I think just the function of hybrids. They're all kind of like that.
Oh, you know what? I'm not actually getting it until October.
That's not that far away.
The Hyundai Ioniq Electric Limited.
Okay.
That's the battery electric version. So no engine at all in that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's the one I'm getting. I'll keep you posted.
All right. So why don't we go back to Ram for a minute? they made a little bit of an announcement yesterday.
A little bit.
Yeah. There's a new Ram 1500 variant that's coming this fall, called the TRX, which we actually, you know, first heard about. They did a concept version back in 2016 that they took to the Texas State Fair, and during FCA's Capital Markets Day in 2018, when they were doing their latest 5-year plan, they said that they're going to build a production version of the TRX, and now it's finally here. And they put a Hellcat in it. And
as you do.
Well, if you're FCA, that is what you do.
Well, I mean, you know, it's okay. So
Hellcat everything.
This annoyed a lot of people who felt the need to comment, like, A, they're trashing the environment. And I understand that it's not a fuel efficient vehicle. That is a definite concern. But also FCA needs to make revenue. So that's another concern. And people have shown that they'll buy very expensive pickups. And so, yes, it's half pointless, but also people will buy it and they don't have anything else. They don't have car platforms. They're trying to finish up their deal with PSA that's going to open up a lot of stuff. So it doesn't make any sense for them to not do what they're doing. Like their only option really is just Hellcat everything.
Look, there's 400 other different types of cars to buy. Buy something else if you don't like it. Nobody's forcing anybody to buy this vehicle. So right. I get it. I understand the concerns, but it's just great fun. I mean, it's, you know,
probably will be a blast, you know, to run this thing across the desert, you know, 700 horsepower. You know, I mean, I've driven the Rebel, you know, which is really good.
I like the Rebel. Yeah. That's a good truck.
You know, and you know, that's, you know, just with even with a V6, you know, it's really good, but they, you know, this thing, you know, with 702 horsepower supercharged V8, you know, is going to outdo everything that's out there right now. What's going to be interesting, you know, is, it's funny, you know, TRX, you know, they call this thing the apex predator of full size off-road trucks, you know, like the Tyrannosaurus Rex was. That's, you know, hence the name.
I actually wonder, what's the Tyrannosaurus Rex action apex predator, or do we just think it was?
Well, everybody perceives it as the apex predator. Who the hell?
Based on what I saw on social media.
They've done the same kind of thing, though. Like, the T-Rex had a huge head and tiny little chicken arms, and like, it was all imbalanced. That's exactly what you have here. A huge engine. All imbalanced.
And tiny little arms.
to their credit, you know, they have actually balanced it out with the chassis as well. I mean, they've made a, you know, basically completely revamped the chassis. You know, this thing's 8 inches wider than a standard 1500. You know, so, you know, it's got a lot more wheel travel capability. You know, it's really set up for high speed off-road driving, or low speed off-road driving for that matter. You know, and FCA knows how to do off-road stuff, you know, as they've shown with Jeep and even with the Ram Rebel and the Power Wagon. But you know, the thing is, you know, the original T-Rex, you know, eventually turned into crude oil. You know, this thing, you know, this really seems like the end of an era. You know, this is probably, you know, this and the next generation Raptor will probably be the last of this type of truck that we see with a big, powerful internal combustion engine. You know, and rumor has it that the new Raptor is going to go back to a V8 instead of the EcoBoost V6. But, you know, we also have coming, you know, a year from now, the GMC Hummer EV, Rivian, at some point, you know, the Cybertruck, you know, Ford's got an electric F-150 coming. And, you know, I mean, these are, you know, especially the Hummer, you know, and the Cybertruck are going to be, you know, really powerful, you know, electric pickups. And that Hummer is going to be very off-road capable too. So, you know, you're going to, this is like the last of a generation, you know, before you start to get into these electric variants of these things.
I think too, the electric stuff is going to, because of just the weight and the packaging, that's going to change the way those trucks actually go across the terrain. You're going to be able to take the electric trucks and they'll fly really stably. Mm-hmm. You know, they're heavy, but once you get them airborne, like they're going to be stable.
And you're going to have momentum on your side.
Yeah. So that's going to be a different kind of truck. So I'll be interested to see what that is. I do think you're right. This probably is sort of the last gasp of this stuff. These are your Superbirds and your Daytonas. That's what these are now. So get them. And it's interesting too. Like you said that the original T-Rex turned into crude oil. This T-Rex brings it all full circle because it's going to consume all of that crude oil.
Yep. And then go extinct.
Yeah. metaphor. We love you. I understand the criticism of it, but I think that it's a really well thought out package. I think it complements the Raptor in the marketplace. And it does stuff that the Raptor doesn't as well. Like it has carved out its niche and there's room for these things. So let's see how long it lasts. It'll be a fad.
I mean, they'll probably build these for a couple of years, you know, and then, you know, wind it down. You know, or as long as people are willing to buy them, you know, really, as long as there's enough customers for it, they'll keep building them.
They're just,
if I lived anywhere that this would be appropriate, as in like out with access to deserts and off roads and stuff like that, I think this thing would be an absolute riot. I love it.
I think you should definitely get one of these in Greenwich and just, you know what, go up along the
go into the back country and show them how it's done. Lines,
right? You're not actually supposed to be there, but see if you can get to Canada along the high tension wires.
Draw a straight line from your house to Canada and see if you can get there with this thing.
And do it while you're towing your own house. Like, just
of course, my tiny house.
Yeah, I'm going to tow my house to Quebec. Yeah,
it's awesome.
Good for them for like keeping things rolling. It is a business after all, and so we don't always agree with every choice that those companies make, but they need to stay around so they can make the things that we want them to make. I'm really interested in the small cars the sales of the Ram TRX will fund.
Yeah, well, and they're also, you know, doing a lot of electrification. Not so much right now until after they finish the PSA merger on full battery electric stuff, but they're doing a lot of plug-in hybrids, starting with the Wrangler this fall. And Jeep recently released a teaser video of the Wrangler plug-in, the 4XE, as they call it, you know, where, you know, you just see this Wrangler kind of silently going through, you know, down this trail and along a river and, you know, past the animals. So, you know, they're not completely ignoring that marketplace.
Yeah, they're working on it. They need to get some working capital going. And, yeah. So the business side of that is really, I think, holding stuff up for both. I don't want to say FCA anymore, but getting the Stellantis merger complete will allow bless all the you. Brands to do what they're doing.
Oh, that's all right. Sorry.
Yeah. But oh, go ahead.
No, I just, after you said Stellantis, I said, bless you.
Oh, yes.
Little joke.
Still hate the name. But talking about the Wrangler is a good place for us to pivot to the Bronco and some first impressions of that one, because they are direct competitors in the marketplace. And I was actually, we were following a Wrangler Unlimited last night in the car. And I was telling my wife, I was like, yeah, I really want to try the Bronco. Like, I think that's going to be a really cool vehicle and different enough on its own. But you guys have seen more of it than I have. So does that hold up?
What did you think, Rebecca? You saw it yesterday in New York?
I did see it for the first time yesterday. And
in its natural habitat.
Of course, right outside of Wall Street, exactly where it's supposed to be.
Did you crush some bankers? Please crush some bankers. Never mind.
I really liked it a lot. I think that they did some really thoughtful design elements to it. As I've said before, it looks like it's supposed to look. I think they did, you know, really thoughtful things. I love the, on top of the dash, there's the gear, this gear rack where you can plug in things like your GoPro cameras and stuff. And it's really, you know, that is one of those like celebrations of how this vehicle is going to be used. I liked the fact that it had auxiliary buttons already pre-wired and connected to the fuse where you can add on lights on the top and, you know, different accessories. Like it works directly with how people are going to use this product. And they recognize that, they embrace it, and they celebrated it. And I think those kinds of elements are really, really cool. It was easy to get in and out of. The four-door was a little bit easier because it had the running boards. The two-door sits high. You know, it had 32-inch tires on it. But once inside, I think they did a good job of refining the interior. You know, I think Ford tends to do some pretty nice interiors. And this one had some elements to it that I really enjoyed. I mean, it was one of those, like, I'm always kind of looking to see, okay, did you think of this and did you think of that? And pretty much everything that I wanted it to have, it has in it. They had this weight-bearing pull-out table in the back that then you can use to climb on it to the top to adjust things on the roof, which was really, really clever. That was probably the only wrinkle, was that I would have loved to have had a footwell built into the corner to be able to get onto that table a little bit more gracefully to then adjust the roof rack things. But just the fact that they thought of making that table a weight-bearing option was again just how they clearly listened to research, read research, and appreciated it. And I think it is going to give Jeep a run for its money. It's going to give people an alternative that they haven't really had before.
Yeah, and, you know, as of last week, they had over 165,000 pre-orders for the Bronco two-door and four-door. They haven't said how many orders they've gotten for the Bronco Sport yet, but you know, I mean, there's clearly a lot of interest in this vehicle. And we did publish a special episode last week where I talked to Rob Gilardi, who was the chief interior designer for the Bronco two-door, four-door, and Scott Anderson, who's the interior design lead for the Bronco Sport, you know, about some of those design decisions they made.
Did you see the Bronco Sport yet?
Oh yeah,
They didn't have one there either.
Yeah, they had. I suspect that the reason they didn't bring one to New York on Monday is because they, you know, they were really emphasizing, you know, they had the F-150 and the Broncos there.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And the press release was really talking about, you know, how Ford makes more vehicles in the U.S. than anybody else, you know, really focusing on that whole made in America thing. And the Bronco Sport's actually going to be made in Mexico.
Yeah. So, well, womp, womp, womp.
But yeah, no, the event I went to last week, they did have the Bronco Sport in addition to the two-door and four-door. And we actually got to go for rides in both the Bronco Sport and the Bronco two-door.
Okay, cool.
At this new ORV park that is opening up here about an hour north of Detroit. And, you know, both, you know, are really impressive vehicles. You know, the Bronco Sport, you know, is very much a competitor for the Jeep Compass Trailhawk.
Right. And we should remind listeners that it's a car base. That's one of the main.
It's based on the same.
It's a very different vehicle, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, they took the Escape this time, is it when they redesigned the Escape and they split it, they made the Escape more car-like because they were also creating this separate vehicle, this rugged off-road vehicle that, you know, where Jeep has, you know, the range of Compasses, and the same goes for their other crossovers that, you know, are, you know, within the same vehicle, you know, are more car-like and, you know, true off-road capability. The Bronco Sport is the off-road rugged version of that. And it's got a lot of neat things like that taller roof in the back, that stepped roof. So it you can get a rack that goes inside and put your mountain bikes inside the vehicle, you know, so they're not outside exposed, likely to get stolen.
That's great. But my one complaint about that is it consumes the rear seat.
Yeah, it leaves you with only two seats.
Yeah, so that's great for that young active couple bikes, who can afford the car.
Yeah,
that goes away when there's kids.
One thing I'll be curious about, you know, the roll bar in the Wrangler is in between the front seats and the back seats, mm-hmm. and the roll bar's in the middle there. The roll bar on this is behind on the four-door, I believe it's behind the second seats. Row.
Yeah.
And I asked about crash test worthiness and they haven't gone through that yet. So I'll be curious to see like rollover and how that.
I expect it'll be, you know, comparable to what
I would think so, but it was a notable change, engineering change that they've done. And I hadn't seen a car with that. I was trying to remember then like vehicles like the Evoque doesn't even have a roll bar.
Yeah. This one, you know, I mean, you've got a full roll bar system in here that goes, you know, across and down the A pillars. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't expect that to be an issue. You know,
I would think that they would have done they did the simulation testing on it.
Yeah.
But it is a notable design difference.
The Bronco two door that I got to ride in, was actually, it had the 4-cylinder engine and the 7-speed manual transmission. So we didn't get to drive. We were riding along with Ford engineers doing the driving. And the 2-door, that 7-speed is actually really a 6-speed plus a crawler gear. So when you put it in that crawler gear and put it in 4-wheel drive low, that's where you get that 95-to-1 crawl ratio. And, you know, we were going through the course just in 4-high. We didn't, he didn't even put it in 4-low, and it had no problem at all going through all this stuff, you know, through all the different kind of terrain that they had in there. You know, it was, I think, you know, it wasn't perhaps quite as challenging as some of the terrain on the Chrysler Proving Grounds off-road course. But
that we've gone through.
I think that, you know, it will probably do just fine. You know, I mean, they've been posting a bunch of videos and photos the last couple of weeks of this thing running Rubicon, you know, along with some Wranglers. So I have no doubt this thing's going to do great. You know, to the, what you're talking about with the design touches, you know, some of the neat things they did that Rob talked about was, you know, at the ends of the dashboard are cut away, you know, they're angled away. And then you've got those grab handles that are on there, which are, by the way, are removable, as is the grab handle that's on the center console. So you can reposition them. But when you look through the grab handle, if you have the doors off, you can actually see right through there. And, you know, they've cut away the dash at the end to really maximize that visibility, so you can see all around you. And they've also got, when you're, you know, running at low, you know, below 20 miles an hour, you can have the surround view cameras on all the time. So they did that. They had the surround view cameras on, so you can see what's right in front of you.
And that's so critical when you're off road.
Oh yeah. So you know, when you're coming up over the crest of a hill or, you know, going over a boulder, you want to be able to see where everything is around you. You know, because when you're coming up a steep hill and then going over the top, you know, you can't see what's on the other side. Having that camera there on allows you to see what's there, which is really, really important. So it's, you know, I think the Bronco's going to do fine, you know, and that the four cylinder, you know, I think it's going to be about 275 horsepower in the Bronco. You know, it's got plenty of power and torque. And the ones we rode in had the 32 inch wheels on them. Mm-hmm. There's also an option for 35s. and also, you know, in the one I was in, you know, it had the drain plug in the floor, so you can get the rubberized floor with a drain plug that you can take out, so you can hose down.
Is that standard?
No, it's optional.
Oh, okay. Because the both of the vehicles they had them, and I love that.
It's standard on some trim levels, optional on others. So, you know, there's just a lot of really, really cool things they did with it, and you know, the doors on the four door, you know, because they made them frameless. So that you can stash them in the back. And, you know, when they decided to make that change so you could stash the doors in the back, they actually had to do a lot of reengineering, you know, to make, you know, so you could slide them into the slots in the back of the cargo area.
Well, and then they also have those cool, like, tubular doors as which were available as
a factory accessory.
Yeah, those were neat looking.
There's going to be a lot of accessories. I mean, one of the things that, you know, that works out great for FCA with the Wrangler is there's this huge range of accessories you can buy, both, you know, through Mopar as well as through third parties. And, you know, there's a lot of profit margin on those accessories.
It's like a Barbie doll for grown men.
Yeah, exactly.
Or G.I. Joe.
Yeah,
we're gender neutral there. They're absolutely killing it on the marketing part of it too. I mean, I think that they're really doing an amazing job keeping momentum up on these things. You know, it doesn't come out until the next spring, I think it is, like a year. Is it a year from now?
Almost? Less than a year, about 9 months from now.
Early 2021 production. Yeah. So, but you know, they're really doing a great job with this buzz because there's a ton of buzz and there's a lot of people really interested in it. One of the things too, to that point on the guy that showed me around Esteban, he said that the knobs and the bolts that you as a consumer can adjust and take off and such, they're all marked with Bronco so that you know whether you can make adjustments to that particular bolt as you come across it in the vehicle, which again, I thought was really just a really thoughtful touch. Mm-hmm. It's cool. They've done a fantastic job. I can't wait for it to come out, and I can't wait to drive it.
Yeah, I mean, they really learned, I think, from the Raptor a lot of lessons about how to do a vehicle like this, a special vehicle with an off-road focus, and they clearly studied real hard about the Wrangler as well. So,
well, I mean, they've got, you know, they take advantage of, you know, 60, 70 years of Wrangler sales and sales and use, you know.
It's good.
But no, they did. It'll be interesting to see how people, if there's an authenticity, you know, because Jeep has obviously been in this landscape for years and decades now, all the way through. And so it'll be interesting to see how the consumer, you know, how many people convert and trade over and go over to from a Jeep to a Bronco.
Yeah. I think there's going to be that crossover audience, and it's also just going to be people who buy the Bronco who wouldn't consider the Jeep. And so they've found a little niche for themselves.
Yeah.
So good for them. It's exciting. It's exciting times. Two completely
fun.
We talked about the Ram and, TRX.
There will be an electrified version of this, you know, at some point, you know, either a hybrid or plug-in hybrid, you know, that's going to be arriving sometime in the next couple of years.
Yeah. So get ready. hopefully we're all still employed by that time. We can afford it. All right. Well, so you know what? We talked about the Ioniq last time. I'm pretty sure. If we didn't, we'll talk about it next time.
Okay.
Because we have some questions to get to. And it's
so let's start with the most important one.
Yes, I was going to say.
From Groovetini. In light of the looming pepperoni shortage, what are your thoughts on pizza toppings? Is pineapple acceptable? Why or why not? Please feel free to personally attack each other's character over this. And I suspect that I will be doing exactly that momentarily, Rebecca.
No. Hang on. Do we need to? Okay. There's a little bit of backstory here. So
yes, we need to fill in the backstory here.
Yesterday, Rebecca tweeted about the pepperoni shortage. And I purposely trolled her by saying, as long as ham and pineapple hold out, which she replied, those should never be allowed on pizza. And apparently there's still like a pizza Twitter thread going on that's like with car Twitter. So I don't know if it's really related or separate or whatever.
And somebody took this way too seriously and talked about freedom of choice and all this BS. And it's like,
just giving each other
crap. Dial back and step away for a minute. This is a pizza discussion. I was really pissed off by that, I have to say.
I think
it's like, come on.
Not everything is that serious. We were just giving each other some grief. Like, eat what you want to eat, but like, yeah. I that's sort of the point I got to. I was like, look, to each their own. I just, you know, I don't like mushrooms. I will eat the hell out of a pineapple and ham pizza, but I get that some people find that disgusting.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, I actually do love ham on pizza. It just has to be called bacon.
Well, that's a different part of the pig.
Well, there's a distinction between ham and bacon. There are two different parts of the pig.
You can mix them. You can
so
mix
I'm
them.
Not adverse to pig on pizza. Right. It just has to be called bacon.
Yeah. Well, and I offended somebody in Canada, too, by saying, like, well, Hawaiian pizza is a Canadian invention. He's like, what are you talking about, Canadian pizza? I was like, oh, my God.
This really took on a life of its own. Like Canadian pizza. I just was upset about the pepperoni shortage.
Yeah. Which is but so
you know to answer Drew's question.
Let's answer his question.
Absolutely, pineapple is acceptable. Anything you want to put on a pizza, if it suits your taste, go for it.
You know,
the beauty of pizza. You can.
It's the TRX of pizza.
You've got so
except it won't be extinct.
You've got a very expansive big tent take on pizza, but there is like the actual like Pizza Institute in Naples. I think it's Naples. That like they're very serious about it, and like the margarita pizza is a particular thing. It was named after the princess, I think. And like,
well, and that's okay. They are allowed to be serious about pizza.
Yeah.
The Pizza Institute in Naples is allowed to be serious about pizza.
but like some places will do the Hawaiian pizza better than others too. Like you gotta, I've had some bad ones.
I have two, all of them. Yeah. Kidding. No, sorry.
you know, if you do it in like the oven, like you get a little char on the pineapple, you get that Maillard reaction going and the sugars.
It caramelizes, right? Yeah. You have to caramelize it.
That's actually absolutely pretty good. You know, like,
yeah, it's still not my, it's not my jam. I respect people. My own brother-in-law, the one that I picked up from JFK an hour ago on our conversation, he absolutely loves pineapple and ham. I get it. He also doesn't have a single drop of Italian blood in him. Unlike me.
Well, that's why.
He's fully half Italian.
Right. That's why. That's not pizza, buddy. Like, you, fine, whatever. Have your bread with vegetables, but that's not. Like, it's not pizza.
Okay, so
next week we'll get into the whole discussion of Chicago style versus New York style.
I don't think there is a discussion there.
All right.
Well, and there's like Detroit style pizza, which is a thing I didn't know about either. Yeah.
And then there's the Greek style in Boston that I became acquainted with, unfortunately, through college.
Unfortunately.
Well, that was suboptimal.
It turns out, actually, that Greek families own a lot of the pizza restaurants around, at least around here in New England. I don't know if it's
They should stick to Nick's Roast Beef in Beverly, Massachusetts. That's my go-to Greek restaurant.
In Ann Arbor is a Greek family that owns Cottage Inn Pizza.
Yeah.
So. All right. Next up from Robert Grace. Loves the show, listens every week. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
Now we've offended his pizza
sensibilities. This is more of a comment than a question, I think. I think the day has passed, long past, that it's okay for professional car reviewers not to have level 2 chargers at their home or office. The idea that EVs are less convenient than internal combustion is really wrong. But you can't know that unless you have easy access to a $500 level 2 charger. So who would like to comment or respond to that?
I understand that. I fully agree with Robert. And if somebody wants to install a level 2 charger in my home, I would be happy to accept that.
Well, no, but see, I think that's almost like the sort of like those are the tools that you use to do the job. So that's like the carpenter and his.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I would love to have a level 2 charger, and it's something that I have explored. So it is something that is on the list of things to do. The less convenient versus more convenient, it's not to say that EVs are not less convenient. My statement on that is that we have not done a good job as an industry of describing how and why. And also you're assuming, I think that for multifamily house people, that is a whole different argument. And many people have agreed that academics in particular have agreed that we haven't solved that challenge yet. I do think that we should look at working with municipalities, working with builders, working with people to install, have a level 2 charger as part of a new build. As I mentioned, I don't have a generator here at home, so I didn't have power. And were I to build a house today, I would certainly pre-wire for both a generator and a level 2 charger. I think that's a really, really good thing. But, you know, I guess I don't see going to the gas station for 5 minutes as a huge inconvenience. And the idea that an EV is somehow more convenient, I haven't quite accepted that yet.
I guess it can be if you're only always charging at home and you don't ever consume all the range. And so I suppose that there is that argument, like, yeah, I have an electric car. I haven't gone to a gas station in months or years or whatever. I can see that.
I can see that too. Yeah.
No, that's perfectly legitimate.
Right. When I will tell you though that when I have had an EV, a full EV, even, you know, so let's pretend like I do have a level 2 charger in my garage. It's still a matter of taking that out in the middle of a snowstorm or a huge rainstorm and having to plug it in. That is not as convenient as driving to a gas station underneath a covered parking area and being able to get gas at a little bit more of my convenience, frankly, when I need to get it, as opposed to needing to charge every single night. You know, and again, we're talking about different ranges and things like that. But so I guess, you know, I've been in that situation where I didn't have a choice. I had to charge, and it was absolutely torrential rain out, and it was a mess, and it was not a nice experience having to do that.
Yeah, I think the real answer here is that, you know, there is no silver bullet. You know, for many customers, an EV is far more convenient. You know, if you live in a single family home, you know, and you're parking the car in a garage,
right,
and you've got a level 2 charger, get out, plug it in, go in the house, you're done.
Get absolutely.
Out in the morning, you unplug it, you drive.
Fully respect that.
But there are, you know, as you said, a lot of people that, if they live in a single family home, if they live in a city, they may have to rely on street parking where, you know, it's not convenient. Or you live in a multi-unit home. And for those people, that's why, you know, we're seeing things like what we talked about recently with GM and EVgo, trying to, you know, make charging more convenient by putting DC fast chargers at the places where people are going on a regular basis and they're going to be staying there for at least 20 to 30 minutes at a time, like grocery stores, you know, so that it, you know, you're taking away the friction, you know, because for a lot of people, there is still friction, and it's there is no one solution that works for everyone.
Right.
You know, and, you know, to, you know, one other thing is that we don't get plug-in vehicles that with that high a level of frequency. You know, whenever I do get one, I do plug it in. You know, I don't have a level two charger yet. I have been looking at what it would take to put one in. But I, you know, I haven't gotten around to it because I just don't get plug-in vehicles that frequently. But I do plug it in when I do. And, you know, I also go and use things like level two chargers, public chargers, and DC fast chargers in order to see what the experience is like for consumers that have to rely on those. Because that's also part of the ownership experience for many people is relying on public charging.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, so, you know, to Robert's point, I'm actually having my electrician come out to the house to look at installing a generator. I had one quote that was $15,000. Thank you, but I'm going to pass on that one. And well, I'm going to ask him also about level two chargers because I do have a solar system. I know I've got a 220 volt running in my house, in my garage rather, and the panel is actually tucked just inside the opening to my garage. So it could potentially be quite easy. I have a perfect spot. I think I have a perfect spot for a wall hung charger. So I'm going to ask him about both of those things and installing that. So it'll be really, I'll definitely, of course, update everyone on what I hear about that. You know, so it's something that, you know, again, it's an iteration. I mean, houses didn't have Wi-Fi, you know, or didn't have, you know, Fios and things like that. And so we've got to try, though, and get as much of that installed as possible at a reasonable cost. And I would certainly encourage anyone, if you're building a house, like my neighbor is next door, and you may or may not hear the hammering of the jackhammer, but, you know, make sure that you've got these things wired for sound, wired for a 220 volt, wired for fast charging.
Yeah, you know, it is a good point though. Like, and this is like, a lot of us are, freelancers. So you can, commit to purchasing thing. If you're getting a lot of EVs or something, like there is that point where it makes sense to actually purchase the hardware. And then as a freelance automotive journalist, you can amortize, you can write it off, for a bit. It's the same as like, there's no way I'm going to buy a really high-end camera, but when I need it, I'll rent it. It would be great for media loans if there was some way to give us experience with those chargers, but the car companies aren't going to install a charger in every reviewer's house. Like, that's not how that's
going. I actually know somebody who got a high-speed charger installed in their home by one of the, not a manufacturer, but one of the high-speed charger suppliers.
That's tricky.
Oh, we'll have to reach out to some of those companies and see if they want to do that for us.
Yeah. I'm always right. Down for free.
So let's get one more here in before we have to go, from Robbie Bartholomew. This is a fairly easy one. Robbie asks, I wonder whether the rules requiring vehicles to be at least 25 years old are due to the emissions of those vehicles. In other words, could I import a modern VW ID.3 electric vehicle that has zero emissions? Robbie, the answer to your question is no. I looked up on the Customs and Border Protection website, and I'll put the link to the page in the show notes.
Cars go through CBP. Oh, I guess they do. Yeah, customs.
Well, customs. And so the way the rules are, it's actually 21 years for emissions. So after 20, a car that's more than 21 years old, you don't have to update it to pass emissions requirements, modern emissions requirements. The 25-year threshold is actually for federal motor vehicle safety standards. And while an ID.3 probably could pass things like the crash test requirements, it probably could pass the crash test requirements if you crash tested it. It definitely would not pass other requirements like some of the lighting requirements and various other rules. And so to import that, you would have to go through and basically do a one-off certification and federalize it to meet current U.S. Motor vehicle safety standards. If you're what you're interested in is something like the ID3, VW will be unveiling the production version of the ID4 in the next few weeks. And it will be going on sale here in the U.S. next year. It'll actually be built in Chattanooga be offered available here. And there's also lots of other options. But no, you won't be able to import an ID3 right now, even though it has zero emissions.
Awesome. And I know we have a couple of other questions, but let's get to those next time.
Yeah.
Because I think there's some good points there.
Yep.
All right. So keep the questions rolling in. And in the meantime, we'll keep our eyes on all the nonsense that goes on in the automotive world. So hit us up and we'll see everybody next time. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, bye. Everyone.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.